the Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Airman First Class Jesus Martinez, case number ACM-39903. I note that today's argument is being conducted under the current COVID-19 pandemic mandates of the Department of Defense and other relevant authorities. In today's oral argument, we consider, one, whether the actual bias and or appearance of partiality by the military judge mandated recusal to ensure public confidence in the judicial process. Two, whether the military judge abused his discretion in failing to compel KMT to answer relevant questions to remedy her obstruction of access to witnesses and evidence. Three, whether this court may consider matters from another court-martial in reviewing a military judge's recusal decision in light of United States versus Jesse, 79 MJ 437, CAF 2020, when appellant did not raise those matters at his court-martial. Four, whether the military judge abused his discretion by not ordering the production of KMT's mother for trial. Per order of this court dated 1 December 2021, we granted counsel for appellant and appellee an additional 10 minutes to make argument, allowing a total of 40 minutes for each party. Further, per order of this court dated 1 December 2021, without opposition, this court granted appellant's request to present oral argument through two different counsel. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, we would reserve 5 minutes.
5 minutes. I will note that whatever time is reserved will be shared between the two counsel. You may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Chief Judge Johnson, members of the court. May it please the court. I am Major General Arroyo, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Allison Weber, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Jesus Martinez. In considering the issues before the court today, there is a substantial doubt about the integrity and fairness of appellant's court-martial for three reasons. First, the military judge failed to recuse himself due to a personal bias under RCM 902B1. Second, the military judge failed to recuse himself due to the appearance of bias under RCM 902A. And third, the military judge abused his discretion in not compelling production of KMT's mother and or not abating the proceeding when valid discovery concerns were raised regarding KMT and the necessity of her mother. Now, in looking at the recusal piece, there are three different, I guess, categories through which you can look at the facts that are in the record of trial. The first is in considering the previous history of the appellant's counsel, his senior defense counsel, and the military judge. The second is kind of intertwined, but looking at the disparate treatment of the government counsel as well as the disparate treatment of the appellant's counsel, and the malintent that the military judge attributes only to appellant's defense counsel, but not to the government throughout the pendency of the trial. Now, in looking at United States v. Uribe, a CAF case from 2021, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces noted that our inquiry is whether the relationship between the military judge and a party raises special concerns. And that is ADMJ at 447. And so looking at here, there are special concerns raised by this case. And that's because at the start of appellant's trial, the military judge came on the record and said, there's something I want to place on the record. And he specifically noted, the chief trial judge informed a group of judges that a defense counsel had specifically complained that a military judge's scheduling order did not comply with the manual for courts martial. Now, that's at R at 7. So he said that the chief trial judge made that comment. And then he proceeded to say that the appellant's senior defense counsel was the one who had raised that complaint. If you look at these three pages or four pages of the transcript, he voices the word complaint 8 additional times, which shows how he was construing what had happened. He made an accusation that senior defense counsel had actually lodged a complaint to his supervisor, the chief trial judge. And then he further referenced 9.1A of the American Bar Association standards, and he stated, expressing dissatisfaction with the military judge's ruling in a specific case to that military judge's supervisor is strictly prohibited. So at this point, these are the facts before appellant, as well as any reasonable observer who is observing the court-martial. So that's all there is. It seems that there's an accusation that the senior defense counsel actually filed a complaint to the military judge's supervisor.
Counsel, do you think it was wrong for the military judge to bring this up at the trial?
Sorry, Your Honor, was it wrong to what?
To bring up what had happened at the conference to the parties at the trial on the record?
No, Your Honor, I don't. The appellant believes that it was entirely proper to bring up that something had happened, but he could have done it in a generalized manner. He could have indicated that the chief trial judge had come back to the after a feedback session with the defense community and had indicated that there was some concern raised about scheduling orders, about ex parte motions, and that he wanted to give both sides, both the government and the defense, the opportunity to voir dire him about any of these concerns. That would, I believe, have been entirely appropriate, allowing transparency and allowing questions to have been raised and asked of him. However, he didn't do that. He came in and specifically said, again, his interpretation, that the senior defense counsel had actually raised a complaint to the military judge's supervisor. And why that is problematic is when you go look at the actual facts from these affidavits that are then presented, 13 affidavits, from defense members in the feedback session with the chief trial judge, that is not what happened. They indicate that this was a conversation with the chief judge, that this was multiple defense counsels, that several issues were raised about the scheduling order, and many of them voiced concerns about the non-attribution policy, and that this was actually coming before a court-martial naming a specific defense counsel. And so because of that, then the senior defense counsel actually asked to voir dire the military judge. And during that, it's very informative what comes out. It comes out that the chief trial judge did not say there was a specific complaint, that instead he said there are some issues that the defense community has raised. When he was asked, do you know how many senior defense counsel are raising this issue? He said, no, I don't know how many are raising it. And in fact, I don't care. Because I knew it was you, special or senior defense counsel, because of the specificity with which it was raised. But that is not what the affidavits show. And additionally, the chief trial judge had indicated that no judge was mentioned and no senior defense counsel was mentioned. So really there is no tie to appellant's counsel in this case other than the military judge himself made that connection. And really, as I mentioned before, the previous relationship between the two is so important in this context. And it really informs why he would have automatically and incorrectly assumed that it was the senior defense counsel.
Counsel, if I could, you know, going back to the judge's word choice, then can't an argument be made that the judge's word choice actually led to a more open and honest discussion on the record of what the situation at the trial conference actually produced in the minds of both the military judge and the counsel? I mean, at the end of the day, we get the affidavits. At the end of the day, we get a voir dire session between where the appellant's counsel has an opportunity to question the judge and all the facts and circumstances of what transpired at this conference actually come to light and are able to be put on the record for us to review at this point. I mean, it doesn't really matter that his initial description of how he interpreted what happened at the conference, didn't that actually lead to a more full and fair discussion of all the circumstances on the record?
Your Honor, I believe there was a more involved discussion on the record. However, the important, I think, aspect is how he interpreted the evidence going in. Even though he was told there was no military judge that was referenced, even though he was told there was no special or senior defense counsel that had been specifically named, he inferred that it was an accusation from the senior defense counsel. And while on the record it's developed more that, in fact, it wasn't, that was his mindset going in, and that really informs the rest of the trial when we see this disparate treatment and this malintent that he does infer. And again, going to that previous case that we're going to discuss under why it should come in United States v. Jesse, that also should inform us because he had a previous negative interaction, very negative, with the senior defense counsel on the record in a previous case, which he did not disclose.
But is there anything in the record in this case that you can point to that shows that may have been his going in point, but at the end of it that he was still of that same mindset? Is there anything in that the military judge said on the record that would lead you to that conclusion?
From the previous case, Your Honor?
No, from what happened here. After the full discussion, is there anything that his initial mindset was still his mindset?
Yes, Your Honor. There are several places. Well, when I was discussing malintent, I think this is a good opportunity to point to when he actually infers malintent to the senior defense counsel that he does not then therefore infer to the government. So, for example, when we look at the opening slides, so defense had actually received a digital expert about, I think, the Friday night going into that weekend, and they started trial on Monday. And so they're going through discovery. They're going through a bunch of different things. They go on the record on a Saturday to discuss Military Rule of Evidence 412. And so the defense has incorporated some evidence into their slides, presented it to the government. Government obviously says, well, we're not really okay with this. And so the judge's response is, and the hopes being that they will throw their hands up in the air, them being the government, because they don't want to delay this case either and roll over on your ability to use this material in trial.
Yeah, so I think my question, counsel, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, but we're getting down the road of other things that transpired. I'm trying to kind of coin this in. At the end of the motion that the appellant's counsel made to recuse himself, is there anything before we get into the trial itself that would point to the fact that the military judge was still of the mindset that his going in facts had not changed, that he was still of the mindset that counsel was way out of line in bringing this up at a trial workshop?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a point where the special defense counsel asked him whether or not there was a reason why he used the word complaint. And again, it's mentioned 8 times during that initial statement by the military judge, and he said that it tracked with Hutchinson's. And Hutchinson is a case that actually involved a complaint from the SJA to the military judge's supervisor. And he said, yes, this seemed to track with what I had seen in that case. So that suggests, even during voir dire, that the reason why he was using complaint was because it tracked with another case he had read, and he believed that that was an appropriate term. He does at some point say, well, maybe concern was better, but he used complaint because it did trigger it. And he says, yes, that tracked with that case. And so that's driven by a voir dire that would suggest that he still believed it was a complaint.
Thank you.
Now, looking at the previous case that had happened several months prior, we would argue that this should come under United States v. Jesse and inform this court's opinion about the military judge's actions in this case for several different reasons. The first is the case that we had cited in our supplemental authorities, United States v. Lynn, which is a CAF case from 2000 that specifically looked at disqualification of an appellate judge. And in that case, which was several years after Fagan, about 40 years or so, they let in these post-trial affidavits to be able to determine whether disqualification of a judge should be considered. And they noted that there was nothing in the record, as this was many months after the record had occurred. So they didn't mention Fagan. They didn't have an issue allowing in this information because it was going to the disqualification of a judge.
Well, if I could ask about that, in Lynn, that case dealt with information that was discovered after the conclusion of trial. Here, the prior case, United States v. Moat, was a case that both the trial counsel and the military, or defense counsel and military judge were involved in. And during the defense's motion for recusal in the voir dire and the later motion for mistrial, defense counsel never raises anything about United States v. Moat. So why is that not waived at this point?
Your Honor, so it's not waived because of the fact that they're in the midst of trial, and this is something that he might not have had access to because he would not have been the person who had received the verbatim record of trial. And as he's just been faced with an accusation from the same military judge indicating he had filed a complaint, it would make sense that he wouldn't want to raise information without having the specifics on hand to be able to really reference to the military judge.
But he had been on the receiving end of a threat of contempt in the prior case, I believe. I would think that would be very much in the defense counsel's the forefront of his mind.
Yes, Your Honor. There are 2 other reasons if you do determine that this is something that is distinguishable for United States v. Lynn that would allow us to still consider it. And those other 2 cases are actually from this court that specifically look at whether or not an error has been raised in the record. And so in Franz, they determined that information can supplement the record if the error itself occurs in the record. And here, the error was the personal bias of the military judge as well as the appearance of bias of the military judge. So for that reason, we would argue it should be able to supplement the record to really go toward his personal bias and appearance of bias. And then the other one that kind of juxtaposes with that is United States v. Teller. And in that case, this court did not consider information from an affidavit written by a defense counsel, which specifically looked at comments that had been, that the defense counsel had overheard from a court member about potentially giving a lighter sentence to the appellant, but for being worried about media attention. And this court said, we didn't reach the substantive merits of this because it's not raised in the record. There's nothing in clemency, nothing to that extent to be able to be to supplement the record. Again, here we have all kinds of information in this record about the personal relationship between the two, the accusation at the beginning against the senior defense counsel by the judge, as well as disparate treatment and the male intent throughout the trial that they have raised. And so that would then supplement the record.
So, counsel, if I can just sort of recap your argument with regard to Jesse. One is that Jesse doesn't really apply to this situation, and that's kind of like Lynn, where Fanyan wouldn't really cover this type of scenario. And two, even if Jesse does cover the situation, then it sort of fits within the exception articulated in Jesse for issues that are raised in the record, but that can't be resolved without reference to external material. Is that fair?
Yes, Your Honor. So the supplement is the second one, and again, as we referenced the Coast Guard to show how a sister service is addressing this issue, and they have, as you noted, distinguished it from Jesse, which was dealing with sentence issues and sentence post-trial confinement conditions with sentence, as opposed to something that would affect the fairness and integrity of a trial, like UCI, which is what they were looking at in that case, and they are the ones who referenced disqualification of a judge as well.
But you would agree that the court in Jesse itself didn't specifically address this type of scenario?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the court in Jesse did not consider this issue as it had probably not been, was not what was before them, and it was not necessarily what the previous cases that they did look at were addressing. But they did, through the supplementing and talking about IUC and things like that, say that we were able to supplement when an issue was raised in the record, and so we do believe that would fall within it.
Just to make sure I understand your argument as well, so you would you also agree that although this wasn't the scenario in Jesse, it's pretty clear the CAP intended Jesse to be a decision of pretty broad application?
Your Honor, having looked at a review of what cases are citing Jesse, most of them do appear to be looking at something involving sentences. And so since Jesse itself involved sentences, and Fagan itself involved a sentence, I am not sure if they were in fact considering that there would be information that would affect the fairness and integrity of a trial that shouldn't come in. And they did allow for supplementing, like with, again, IAC, so ineffective assistance of counsel, which I think is comparable here, because if something affected the whole trial, like UCI, like an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, those things would affect the fairness and integrity of a trial, and they're allowed to supplement. And here, this would be something that could also supplement to show whether the military judge, in fact, harbored a personal bias against appellant. So that the argument for why we believe that should come in is specifically going into this several months prior, the military judge had censored on the record regarding intemperate comments in a written filing by the senior defense counsel, and then later verbally reprimanded him and threatened him with contempt. So that informs why he would have automatically assumed there was an accusation by the senior defense counsel during this feedback session. And again, he said, I didn't care how many senior defense counsel were raising this. In fact, it didn't matter to me. And so that's why, because he immediately assumed, negatively and incorrectly, that this was the person raising that issue.
Wasn't the judge fairly clear that his specific concern during the voir dire that, in general, he wasn't opposed to counsel raising concerns to the chief trial judge in that situation, but it was because this was a pending issue in a current court-martial? And if that was his concern, is that not a legitimate concern?
Your Honor, I believe it would be a legitimate concern. However, that's not what the facts show, because the senior defense counsel said, Your Honor, you know, have you seen this in other cases? And he said, only this case. And then the senior defense counsel said, well, I guess I could supplement the record, but this actually was, in fact, raised in a previous case with another counsel. And then the military judge said, yes, well, I assumed it was you because you raised it in this case and a previous case. If it's raised in a previous case, those concerns over the pending matter are no longer a concern.
Well, if it was raised in a previous case, that doesn't change the fact that it's also pending before this judge and this counsel right now, does it?
Yes, Your Honor. And the military judge also explained that he had actually already given a ruling, as well as he's already written his ruling prior to being told anything about this. So even then, this pending matter had really already been decided. So it was not really going to have any effect at this point. The pending matter is really something he just had to give them a written ruling on. It had already been decided. And again, so it was something that was raised before, suggesting it was on the mind of senior defense counsel, and those affidavits show that this was a concern raised actually prior, in a whole year earlier, to a previous chief judge, Judge Schools, where they had been talking about issues with scheduling orders, and it was a continuation of that concern talking about ex parte motions as well as scheduling orders. So those affidavits show that this was not something unique to this case and that many judges were likely facing it, as well as many of the defense community were all concerned, and that's why the military judge or the chief judge came back and said, hey, these are some issues that the field has seemed to be seeing. Now, looking at that issue informing the rest of the trial, there are several places where there are disparate treatment of, and again, male intent inferred by the judge to the defense counsel that we don't see with the government. The first one I mentioned was with the opening slides. The second one is with regards to the senior defense counsel actually forecasting a concern over 404B evidence potentially coming in during KMT's direct, as he had not been able to interview her. And he even said, sir, you know, I want to forecast. We haven't gotten any notice. And specifically, the judge said to the senior trial counsel, well, do you expect there's anything that needs to be noticed? And he said, no, Your Honor, we've already interviewed her. And that is actually coming in at R.A.T. 48. Now, during her cross, she was asked about what had happened that day, and she says, the next morning, he, the appellant, had tried to engage in sex again, and I told him no. And I told him no a couple of times, and then I told him no that. And then there was an objection. And so this is the objection that the senior defense counsel says, Your Honor, this was not noticed. This is 404B potentially. And then the judge looks at the senior our trial counsel, and the trial counsel says, yes, for this we haven't given notice. There's no Article 39A session that happens. There's no male intent inferred to the circuit defense counsel or trial counsel, even though this had already been forecasted as a potential concern. Again, contrast that with how the defense is treated when there's a discovery issue with their opening slides. Very different in the way that the judge looks at these two things, even though the CDC had forecasted this concern. Again, looking at when we get to opening statements, there's an objection related to 412. And so they go into a closed hearing. I won't reference anything discussed with regards to that, but just some of the comments that come out from the trial counsel at that point. And he says specifically that he discusses the fact that I'm not sure if this is just bad faith or bad lawyering. I'm not sure if they're trying to pull something over on you, Your Honor. And then rather than the judge saying anything, again, this would be considered distemperate comments, suggesting potentially even IAC, he says nothing. And then he actually looks at the defense and says, you know, I'm trying to be patient with issues that keep arising. They keep popping up when I've actually made a ruling. And then they go on, and then at a later point, the defense tries to explain, well, are we withdrawing your ruling? The judge actually overrules the objections, determining that that was correct. They hadn't been doing anything wrong. But he does suggest that they are skirting the line, and he suggests that they are actually trying to get something in through, like, a back doorway of implying 412 that had been kept out. So, again, suggesting that he's having malintent with this senior defense counsel and the defense team as opposed to with the government. And the government never even gets told to be careful in what they're saying, that they're being discourteous, even though they then go on to say that the military judge is flaunting, or that the senior defense counsel is flaunting the issue and also is being disingenuous.
Just from a more broader perspective, I was wondering if you'd give us a sense of where exactly is appellant saying that the judge erred on the recusal piece? Is it an error? Was it an error for him not to recuse himself at the end of the motion for recusal, and then the remainder of the incidents that occur throughout trial go to prejudice? Or is it more of a kind of a spectrum where the judge was required to recuse himself at multiple points?
Your Honor, I believe that if there would have been a full disclosure on the record about the previous history he had at the time that the motion for recusal, that reasonable person with all of the facts fully informed would have concerns about his impartiality. Now, that did not come out because those facts were not specifically relayed. However, I do believe that even at that point, knowing that there was an accusation that he was making against the senior defense counsel that was not supported, there is a concern even at that point about the impartiality. However, if Your Honors don't agree, clearly looking at the whole trial, when we get to the motion for mistrial, at that point, looking at all of the places where there's different treatment, the malintent he infers to the defense that he doesn't infer to the government, as well as the initially starting point with that accusation, that is when we would be able to say he definitely, all those facts suggest he should have recused himself, and many of those facts, in fact, go to prejudice. Your Honor, I do see that I am running out of time for the other issues, so pending any further questions that potentially I can answer during rebuttal, I will then yield to my counsel.
Thank you. Chief Judge Johnson, honorable members of the court, with respect to the second and fourth issues, which are necessarily intertwined, we would contend that the real issue here is whether the military judge abused his discretion in failing to hold the government to their discovery obligations pursuant to both Brady and Stellato, and in failing to fashion a remedy for the injustice caused by those discovery violations, as well as KMT's obstruction. Namely, that he failed to compel production or abate the proceedings to allow for discovery. So, as presented in our motion, this case raises a quandary for the court of whether a victim's statutory rights should be trumping an accused's constitutional rights. And originally, the judge grounded everything in Article 46. I can't make her do a pretrial interview with you. Equal opportunity is not equal access. However, the judge was also aware that she was withholding information and directing other witnesses to withhold information, and that the government knew this, and yet he said, there's really nothing I can do. When you look at the offenses, the accused's rights, he has a right to present a defense, a full defense to his case. The key here is it of such central importance to an issue that it is essential to a fair trial? The judge never really let them get to this point because he let the obstruction control everything. He never looked at whether the government had actually gotten into the rest of the due diligence. Now, obviously in the record, the defense says, hey, yes, they've been helpful, they asked questions, they tried to get the information. But what comes out here is something else. They still objected to the defense getting relief, even though they knew that this obstruction was occurring. And when you also look at that, is the fact that she's hiding her mother, who we knew at the time of the motion was the second outcry witness and where the turning point occurred, is that the withholding of the mother's contact information, hiding her from this case, per se exculpatory? The government had an obligation to look into that. Per Stellato, if you have reason to believe that there is exculpatory evidence, even if it's not in your control, you can't bury your head in the sand. You have to go look for it. In this case, they knew that she was hiding the information. They knew that she was refusing to provide the interview and that she was getting another witness to do the same, which is an
added. Isn't there an innocent explanation for her not wanting investigators or lawyers to talk to her mother about this difficult situation? Is that necessarily evidence of exculpatory information?
If that was the only piece, if we just knew she had talked to her mother and nothing else was at play here, potentially that would meet something. But she's not hiding her as a part of a privilege. There's no privilege to be asserted. She just doesn't want her involved. And the question becomes why. And where we believe this is, you know, really against the accused's rights is the fact that the defense laid out a timeline as to why the timing of that call was of critical importance. And that actually leads to another discovery issue.
Counsel, before we get there, can I follow up on that? I mean, at the end of the day, KT took the stand in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
She was subject to cross-examination after the military judge had granted leeway and extra time for the appellant's counsel to prepare. She answered every question that was asked of her from appellant's counsel. She didn't refuse to answer any of the questions on the record. And there was no attempt to petition the judge at any point during that to force her to answer a question.
That does not mean that she...
Didn't the appellant get his full opportunity to question and challenge this witness?
No, Your Honor, because, again, she's withholding actually the contact information of two witnesses, and by virtue of hiding the first one, she's also hiding the second one, because as relayed through the father, her ex-boyfriend, who was also requested by defense, the contact information would lie with the mother. She would know it.
But the defense never sought to compel the contact information.
They requested to put the witness on the stand to have the information disclosed.
Well, what they said to the military judge is they wanted to put her on the stand for the purpose of the motion in order to establish the materiality of KMT's mother's production.
Yes, Your Honor, but when you put her on the stand and you've already asked for this information repeatedly, you would ask that question, and therefore they would have gained access. But the bigger picture is when you cross, you're stuck with the answer. And when there's people out there who have relevant information, the defense has to be able to get to that when there's a reasonable ground to get there. And that's where the timeline comes in, And that actually leads to a concern, and it actually goes back to the recusal issue, of the disparity in how they look at this. In the case, obviously in this motions hearing, the defense made the timing of this conversation of critical importance, saying, hey, on the way there, oh, it's still, I love you, honey, I'm home. And now it's I'm talking to my mom. Immediately after she gets off the phone with the mom, they break up, and then these allegations flow. So that makes the timing of critical importance. And I would actually reference United States versus Island, 1993 CMR Lexus 666. In that case, the defense was seeking to produce a doctor who did a sane exam, essentially, and a translator who was present. The only purpose for the production of these witnesses was that she didn't have any visible injuries from the exam, and that the translator thought her demeanor was inconsistent with the allegations. That's impeachment. That's all it is. And in that case, the judge said this is of critical importance because it goes directly to the credibility of the complaining witness. That is the same case here. No matter what came out of the mother's mouth, even if she said exactly the same thing that KMT was reporting now, if she said it exactly the same, the defense would be able to say, okay, they've colluded on this. It's pretty clear about that. But it's also unlikely because we know that the KMT lied. She admits that she lied. She hid the timing of the conversation, and that comes out. So no matter what, that is going to be evidence provided by the mother, and it creates another discovery issue. But where going back to why this is of significance, the government knew the timing was wrong at the time of this motion. They stated in a pretrial interview that they had that information, that they didn't want to confuse the court to say that, yes, I was aware that she talked to her mom on the way home, but she didn't come to me and say, I lied right here about this text message. The judge, going back to, he did not look at that at all. He said, I don't see that as Brady at all. She didn't say she lied to you, so there's no way we get to Brady. Well, first of all, that is a completely improper thought process on Brady, improper application and understanding of both Brady and Giglio, because the government doesn't need somebody to tell them that they're lying in order to know that they're providing inconsistent information. When she said in the pretrial interview, I spoke with my mother on the ride home, and all of the evidence that's being presented in this motion say the critical importance comes because of this timeline, and that's different than what she's saying in the interview, the government had an affirmative obligation to notice that to the defense and notice that to the court for the necessity assessment.
Counsel, a couple things. When you say the timeline, you're referring basically to the sequence of the text messages where the tone shifts after she says she's talking to her mother?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't the defense making an assumption about what was happening outside of those text messages? I mean, this text, did KT tell the government that she didn't talk to her mother on the drive home, and that's how they would have known that this was not true? Or is it that she could have talked to her mother on the drive home, and at other times she could have done it multiple times, so the text message wasn't necessarily erroneous, it was just incomplete?
Your Honor, while I see where you're going with that, at the end of the day, though, she withheld the information. She also did admit that she lied, and had they noticed that the timeline was different in their pretrial interview as opposed to the evidence, that would have given defense more reason to ask additional questions to preserve the necessity of this witness, asking the questions of the witness of who did you speak to and when. Also, the government acknowledged later in the trial that they knew she spoke to another witness as part of the outcry process that was never noticed to the defense. So effectively what we have is the government has more information than the defense. The judge has enough information to say, well, the government concedes that you've met the standard for relevance, and the issue comes down to necessity. When the government's withholding certain facts in order to make that assessment, and the judge is doing absolutely nothing because he says, I can't compel a victim because of a pretrial interview, he is creating a judicial just complete error in how he's supposed to manage the trial. A military judge is not supposed to simply be the referee between two sides. They are supposed to step in and ensure the fairness of the system and ensure that justice takes place.
So Counsel, to make sure I understand your argument, it sounds like maybe there's two things going on, because I think you used the term obstruction a couple of times in relation to what K2 was doing. Is that fair?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if she's obstructing, what law or what rule is it that she's violating that leads you to say that she was obstructing?
What law? The fact that she's telling another witness not to answer questions?
What prevents her from doing that, is my question. Why is that unlawful?
Well, I mean, for any military witness, it's codified in the MCM.
Is she a military witness?
She is not, but equating that back to the military process, we still have someone who is knowingly interfering with the process. And if it has to come back to the military witness, okay, she's obstructing, maybe we can't do anything there, but that's all the more reason for the trial counsel to actually seek this information. And what becomes apparent, the trial counsel says that they did a little bit, and again, we agree that they did some, but there are several instances in the record where they also acknowledge that they could have done more. For one, they had the address of KMT, and presumably the address would have led them to the mother because she said she lived at home. That was something that never got done in this process. They never even sent OSI to try to go to an address to see if she was there.
But the defense also never sought to compel KMT's mother's presence until they're before the judge, right? I mean, they never sought to compel her production prior to trial through trial counsel. They only asked in discovery, what's the contact information? Is that right?
Well, they asked in discovery for the release of the information, and then they asked to be able to speak to her. I think the logical next step was to compel production, but whether they filed a specific request for that, they didn't, as the court noted, they didn't meet the requirements for that. So they were trying to fashion, again, a remedy to ensure justice and the constitutional rights of the accused.
And I'd like to ask you about, I guess, the remedy or what it is that you think that should have occurred here. The way you capture the assignment of error is failing to compel KMT to answer relevant questions to remedy her obstruction. What are those relevant questions, and at what point in time was that supposed to occur? Are you pointing to the judge's refusal to hear from her on the motion, or is it in a pretrial interview, or is it both?
No, Your Honor, we were referring to in the motion when the defense said they wanted to call her for the purpose of the motion. He indicated that that was not his role to put people on the stand to make them answer questions to help a party. But in looking at the totality of this, it was an abuse of discretion not to order continuance and discovery pursuant to Brady and Stellato, and it was an abuse of discretion not to abate the proceedings to allow that to happen. And I would simply ask you to look at the Peyton O'Brien case cited in our supplemental citations to see how they did the analysis of constitutionally required, and that was about a privilege, but constitutionally required for the defense as compared to privileged information of the victim. And the court essentially said, if that's the case, you have to ensure the fairness so you abate the proceedings. That's supposed to allow them the opportunity to try to seek that information through an alternate source. In this case, when they realized that they had a full name of the mother, an address, and then they had the name of the ex-boyfriend, they also had his age and his presumably home of record, they abandoned all of their efforts at that point and effectively said, unless the court tells me I have to do this, I'm not going to.
Counsel, if you could quickly conclude. If you could conclude, please.
Oh, yes. So basically, we believe that with the totality of the circumstances and at the time of the motions hearing, the fact that the government had reasons to believe that they needed to disclose information and failed to do so, and then the judge's failure, both at the time of the motions hearing, to order some fashion, some remedy, even if it's not to compel them to testify on the stand to this, he abused his discretion in not giving any remedy and foreclosing abatement for the rest of the trial, which he then didn't strike the testimony when this was re-raised. So he abused his discretion several times, and when these inconsistencies came back up later, that should have, again, triggered this issue as to why the discovery part was critical and how this lack of discovery on the government's part was the problem. So his failure to order the continuance and discovery or the abatement of the proceedings in the absence of a law letting him compel her to testify would have remedied the situation, and that was within his role as the judge of the case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Johnson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major John Patera, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Naomi Dennis, we represent the United States in this matter. Appellant asks this court to find that the rulings of the military judge reflected, the military judge reflected bias against the defense counsel rather than determinations based upon the facts before him or his understanding of the law. Or that various comments directed towards counsel over the course of a hotly contested court-martial showed that the military judge did something other than exercise ordinary control over the proceeding. The record does not support these claims. This court reviews for an abuse of discretion the military judge's denial of motions related to judicial bias, in this case the recusal motion and the mistrial. That same standard applies to issues involving the production of KMT and KMT's mother, and under this deferential standard, this court should uphold the military judge's rulings unless he misunderstood the facts, misunderstood the law, or came up with a decision that was clearly outside the range of choices reasonably available to him based upon the facts and the law. And when the court applies that standard, it becomes clear that appellant's claims must fail. Now, before I get to the three substantive issues involving one bias and witness production, I want to briefly talk about the issue specified by the court in United States v. Jesse, whether it can consider outside-the-record materials. So, as was developed a little bit by the questioning of this court by my friends across the aisle, appellant was given the opportunity to voir dire the military judge about the potential basis for bias. His lead defense counsel questioned him about a host of issues, not only his comments with his supervisor, the chief trial judge of the Air Force, relating to that issue that was raised at the outset of trial, concepts of non-attribution in an academic setting, and the military judge's thoughts about whether that trumps the obligation not to talk about matters pending before a court, a brief interaction that the circuit defense counsel and the military judge had at a dinner during the circuit annual training. But never once was this previous court-martial, United States v. Mott, that took place approximately 18 months before appellant's court-martial reference. Not once. And actually, my friend across the aisle did mention that the circuit defense counsel referenced a different case, United States v. Greiger, about the concept of their interactions and raising this motion about failure to recuse and relief from the scheduling order. Found it appropriate to reference that previous interaction, but not this case, United States v. Mott, where there was, in appellant's telling on appeal, such evidence of bias as to raise doubts about the military judge's fairness and impartiality. So despite ample opportunity and the circuit defense counsel's knowledge of this previous interaction, it was not raised. And Judge Key, I think you asked a very important question. Why was this issue not waived by the failure to raise that? And while it wasn't briefed by the parties, the United States relied upon United States v. Jesse in its brief. It becomes clear when you look at the standard for waiver, intentional relinquishment of a known right, and the knowledge of senior circuit defense counsel in voir direing the military judge and raising both the recusal motion and later the motion for a mistrial, that this was something that was intentionally not asserted. What was asserted was an allegation of initially apparent bias and then later actual bias and apparent bias in the motion for mistrial in this court-martial, an appellant's court-martial. On appeal, what appellant tries to bring in is an allegation of bias that stems from 18 months prior. That's a new allegation. It was not raised, despite ample opportunity to do so before the court-martial was closed, and that constitutes waiver.
Well, counsel, are you suggesting that in order for it to be raised in the record that moat has to be raised specifically or just the issue of bias?
Your Honor, the government's position is that moat would have to be raised specifically or at a minimum some reference to the previous interactions between counsel. Here, while appellant raised allegations of bias tied to this court-martial, did not mention at all United States v. Jesse. And that actually is an interesting segue to some of the cases cited by appellant's counsel in their supplemental citation to authority, specifically United States v. France and United States v. Teller. In both those cases, this court declined to consider matters that may have related to a a pretrial, trial, or post-trial event generally referenced in the record, but because there wasn't specific information tied to this complaint that's being raised, that was not enough. So here you have a general allegation of bias raised by appellant tied to this court-martial, but does not mention anything. So if you look at the general rule of preclusion announced in United States v. Jesse, which is the seminal case by our superior court in 2020, saying that generally we are not considering matters outside the record, and you turn to the exceptions under Jesse, specifically the second exception, that says that this court can consider matters that are necessary for resolving issues raised by the record, raised by materials on the record. A review of the entirety of the record in this proceeding shows an absence of that previous transcript, so this court should not consider it.
So a couple things. So if the standard under 902 is what a reasonable observer or a rational observer might think about the appearance of partiality on the part of the military judge, and that's a fully informed, or it's an observer with knowledge of all the circumstances, isn't there an argument that the circumstances are the prior include the relationship between the military judge and the defense counsel?
Your Honor, I think that can be split into a couple different ways. One, there are lots of facts about the relationship, or I should say there are some facts about the relationship between circuit defense counsel and the military judge that did make their way into the record here. And in one of those instances, during the voir dire of the military judge, circuit defense counsel voir dire the military judge about their professional relationship. And he said, I quote, noting that we sit in the same building when we're not on the road and we never discuss ongoing cases in an ex parte fashion, you've always had an open door to me. Our families have socialized the holiday parties. You've always invited me to sit down for conversations about the Air Force, about officership, and been a mentor to me in those things. Has any of that changed as a result of this? And both men agreed that it had not. So to answer your question, should the prior relationship between the parties be some of the facts that a fully informed member, a reasonable person fully informed of all the facts regarding the relationship, consider? Absolutely, that fact is in the record, and that person should consider it. That hypothetical person should consider it. But in this case, an allegation of bias does not open the door to any and all interactions between the military judge and counsel just because it's an allegation of bias. And I think that's where the Jesse is instructive to this court, and also considering it through the lens of waiver or at a minimum forfeiture, where circuit trial counsel, aware of the interaction, aware of the import of the allegation to the potential relationship between the parties, would consider it and not think it relevant to put in the record.
All right. And before we move off of Jesse, if I could ask you a hypothetical just to sort of flesh out your understanding of Jesse.
Yes, Your Honor.
So suppose there's a trial, and after the trial and after once the case is on appeal, it comes out that the military judge and the trial counsel were in a romantic relationship during the trial. But there's no evidence of that anywhere in the record. That might have implications for partiality or bias on the part of the military judge. Under Jesse, what would be the defense's remedy to try and address that situation?
Well, Your Honor, under Jesse, I don't think that the defense has a remedy to supplement the record in the manner that they're attempting to do in this case. However, there are other remedies authorized under the code, whether it be a petition for a new trial, because this would be something that was discovered after the closing of the case and was not discoverable through reasonable diligence of the party. Could be a collateral attack through something like a habeas proceeding or a writ of quorum nobis, something that gets at the fundamental nature of that concern. So the defense is not without a remedy in addressing this, even if Jesse would preclude supplementing the record.
Thank you.
I would say, it seems to me that Lynn is sort of grounded in this idea, and to the extent the appellant provided the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals order, which obviously isn't binding on us. It seemed like kind of what underpinned both of those was this idea that there are concepts that are such of bedrock importance to a court-martial that they can be brought up outside of the record. And I kind of, because in those cases they dealt with UCI and they dealt with disqualification. Here we're talking about the fairness and impartiality of the judge. Wouldn't it seem like that would fall outside of the restrictions in Jesse? As one of the exceptions in Jesse is ineffective assistance of counsel, you know, another important right the accused holds. So is there an argument for
looking beyond, I guess, the four corners of Jesse to find other cases where we are going to be allowed to supplement the record, even though they don't necessarily fit neatly within that case?
Your Honor, I think that Jesse, this court is bound as a lower court to look at the four corners of Jesse, because that's the seminal case collecting the lines of precedent of military authorities leading up to 2020. And so in that case, they announced the general rule that we're not considering extra record materials, tying to the Court of Military Appeals case in Fagnan. So we have this general presumption to the one side, and then we have two exceptions to that rule. One that we've already discussed, necessary to supplement materials raised in the record, and then things related to Article 55 and Eighth Amendment claims. But looking at the second kind of bucket, for lack of a better term, of authority, the court specifically enumerates cases or topics, and you alluded to one of them, Your Honor, ineffective assistance of counsel, where previous courts, and with the benefit of stare decisis, they will continue and not disturb that line of precedent to allow supplementation of the record. But this particular allegation is not included in Jesse, is not expressly referenced in Jesse. There are other modes for relief, as I indicated earlier, to address this fundamental concern. And then tying back to this court's opinion in United States v. Teller, it was actually an allegation of UCI. The appellant attempted to attach a declaration from trial defense counsel claiming to have overheard a member make comments about the nature of a sentence and maybe it would have been different if they weren't concerned about some outside pressure. This court declined to consider that case under Jesse because it was not raised at any point in the record. And I think the facts of this case, the manner in which trial defense counsel did not raise this issue necessitates the same result as what this court did in Teller. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
You did, thanks.
Okay. And I guess at this point, I'll move on to the issue of bias. I keep using the phrase seminal case, but one of the seminal cases discussing the issue of bias is United States v. Latecky. That's a Supreme Court case from 1944, and it's in the party's briefs. And Justice Scalia, writing for the majority of the court, talked about what constitutes bias and what does not. And he gave a specific example of what would be actual bias. Looking back to a World War I era case, Berger v. the United States from 1921, where German Americans were being charged under the Espionage Act, Justice Scalia highlighted that the district court judge was alleged to have said that German Americans, who were the defendants in this case, not counsel, German Americans, it was hard to maintain their impartiality because, quote, their hearts were reeking with disloyalty. That was the kind of favoritism and antagonism as to make fair judgment impossible. But what Justice Scalia noted does not constitute a basis for a recusal motion, not establishing bias or partiality, however, are expressions of impatience, dissatisfaction, annoyance, and even anger that are within the bounds of what imperfect men or women, even after having been confirmed as federal judges, sometimes display. A judge's ordinary efforts at courtroom administration, even a stern and short-tempered judge's ordinary efforts at courtroom administration, remain immune. And given that strong language, it's not surprising that Justice Scalia would say that opinions are, quote, proper grounds for appeal, not a recusal, and that critical or disapproving remarks, even hostile remarks, are not grounds for recusal. So appellant at trial had the burden of showing that the military judge's ordinary efforts at courtroom administration evince bias, and he didn't. Starting with the motion for recusal, and I think this gets to one of your questions earlier, Judge Key, about what evidence was placed in front of the military judge and the things that followed the recusal motion, assuming under the abuse of discretion that if the court were to find an abuse of discretion, the things that follow, is that part of the recusal motion or does that get towards prejudice? The government's answer is that the things that followed the recusal motions are only relevant for assessing prejudice. What the military judge was looking at is what this court should be looking at under the abuse of discretion standard. And what the defense marshaled to support recusing the military judge, who had an equal duty to remain on the case when appropriate as to recuse himself when appropriate, and had a duty to exercise control over the courtroom. But what they marshaled was the judge's own words during voir dire, where he specifically disclaimed bias. He was open, he was candid, he put the matter on the record, and it gave the parties an opportunity to voir dire him. And relevant to the defense's claim that there was some sort of preferential treatment of the government, he gave the defense the opportunity to voir dire him after they already waived the opportunity to voir dire him. He still submitted himself to that, answered their questions. And by the end of it, it was clear that he was no longer calling this a complaint, which, by the way, was reasonable given the information that he had at the time.
Counsel, can I interrupt you?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, why in this case, you know, given the fact that there was this full discussion of the issues and it was apparent on the record that the military judge was frustrated about what transpired at the workshop, why wouldn't the more prudent thing have been to recuse himself?
Your Honor, that gets to the notion that a military judge has a duty to remain on a case when it's not appropriate to recuse themselves. It's an equal duty. Our Superior Court's been very clear about that. So these comments that the military judge raised at the outset, which is appropriate under RCM 801, the discussion makes clear that the military judge, if there are any potential issues, he should put that out there for the members and submit himself to voir dire. He did that. He raised a potential issue for the members to consider. And based upon the voir dire and the evidence that was marshaled in support of it, it was not appropriate to recuse himself. He shouldn't be making decisions on recusal based upon convenience. It's a high standard for a reason. There's a presumption that military judges are impartial for a reason.
I think some of the facts that came out, though, counsel, was that the military judge was initially wrong in his impression of what transpired at the workshop and had maybe jumped to conclusions that maybe defense counsel had done some things that you know, when we get a chance to see the affidavits and that kind of stuff that come out, knowing all of that at the end of it, again, why isn't it the prudent thing to do to say, well, why create an issue? Why not just recuse myself?
Your Honor, if I could respectfully push back, I don't know if the military judge was necessarily wrong. A lot of the distinction is the more nuanced characterization of, is it a complaint, is it a comment that was made by Circuit Defense Counsel to the military judge's supervisor at the circuit training a week before trial while a matter was still pending before the court. To the extent that the military judge used the word complaint and that caused concern to Circuit Defense Counsel, he presented the issue, gave the parties the opportunity to voir dire on the matter, and then considered the other evidence that was marshaled in support, which was limited to just affidavits from the circuit counsel who were attending the proceeding. And they provided the military judge with important context that, to the extent that the military judge misunderstood what happened, that was not the case. That circuit defense counsel never mentioned his name. It was brought up in an academic setting. They did not perceive it as a complaint. And so at the time of the military judge's ruling on the recusal motion, any misconceptions that he had have been corrected. And his ability to disclaim the matter is highly relevant to this court's inquiry as to whether he abused his discretion.
Thank you.
Now, there was minimal evidence for the recusal motion. Fast forward to the end of trial, and the defense has raised a motion for a mistrial. This court is again applying the abuse of discretion standard to determine what whether the appellant had met his burden or whether the trial defense team had met their burden to show the military judge that recusal was appropriate. And as my appellant's counsel has noted, they marshaled three distinct lines of a complaint for the military judge's consideration in support of the mistrial. One of them, I think, is very important for this court to consider, because in the context of an allegation of judicial bias, context is key. Because without context, you cannot understand whether the military judge was being reasonable, unreasonable, or something in between. And in this case, one of the complaints was the alleged disparate treatment between the handling of closing argument slides for the government and opening statement slides for the defense. Now, the military judge, while this accusation is being lobbed at him, provides a on-the-spot explanation of why he handled it differently. He noted there was a difference in a discovery. There were discovery concerns implicated by the defense slides that were not implicated by the government slides. And when you look at his extemporaneous statement about that and compare it to the actual interaction between defense counsel and the military judge when the opening slides happen, it becomes clear that the military judge's determinations are imminently supported by the record. And his summary of it, his characterization of it, is imminently supported by the record. So when you go back to the beginning of trial, the defense has filed a motion for an expert in digital forensics. The military judge grants it at the late motions hearing, and in the process of granting it, asks the defense if they understand that this might draw some discovery obligations on their part. Telegraphs or inquires whether the defense might be requiring continuance to work with their expert. The defense says they understand the discovery obligations. They understand that this is a short timeline, but they're willing to work through the weekend. And in fact, they did, and the military judge commended them on the record for putting the effort in to keep the trial going. But then, during opening statement, when the defense sought to publish their slides to the members, it included complete extractions of the text messages between the accused and both of the named victims, replete with timestamps and all. And you can see a interaction between the military judge and counsel as he tried to understand just what was the theory for admissibility, why did they think that they could put these text messages in. And what became clear after about three pages in the transcript is that the defense did not intend to put these text messages in as substantive evidence. They intended to use them to cross-examine the named victims on them, and they intended to use this as a demonstrative aid without articulating a theory of admissibility, without moving to pre-admit, and frankly, based upon the exchange between the military judge and the defense counsel, made it seem as though they had not even provided this information to the government in discovery. They were just seeking to publish these PowerPoint slides before the members at the outset of trial.
Is their opening statement? They could simply read them to the members if they wanted to, couldn't they? Even if they never had any intention of admitting them. And then the problem with that is you get to the end of the trial, and the judge directs the members that, you know, counsel's statements are not evidence, and then the government can sit there and say, well, you heard what the defense promised you. None of that ever came to fruition. I mean, why does the military judge get to jump in and tell the defense what they can and cannot say during their open statement based upon questions of admissibility when the items haven't even been offered in evidence yet?
Your Honor, even if this court takes the view that the military judge could not shape the opening statement and curtail them from putting up the extractions with the timestamps and promising that that evidence is going to come in, there still is the problem of discovery. The defense said even if they're going to put something in their opening statement and have not provided it in discovery, that creates serious concerns for a military judge who is trying to preside over a hearing impartially, trying to ensure that it's conducted in a manner that avoids waste of time and is geared towards the ascertainment of
the truth. I'll say, though, that at the end of the break, they come back, and there's not a lot of explanation what happened, but the judge says the defense has complied with their discovery obligations.
So Your Honor, maybe I didn't understand the question. I'm sorry. Could you repeat?
So they take the break, right? And they come back on the record, and the judge puts on the record the defense has complied with their discovery obligations. We don't know if they complied during that break or if the judge realized that the defense had, in fact, provided the information over the weekend, which is what the defense was saying.
Yes, Your Honor, and this court can have a difference of opinion in how the military judge should have handled it, but I don't think that that constitutes either an abuse of discretion. Well, I don't think that constitutes evidence of bias for the purpose of the motion for a mistrial. It also certainly, this is characterized as a disparate treatment in the handling of the defense opening slides and the government closing argument slides. That somehow there were no different equities at play. This is an apples to apples comparison, when in reality it's an apples to oranges comparison. And so, again, even if the court disagrees with how the military judge handled it, I don't think anything in the record suggests that that was done out of bias, that that was done to give one party a strategic advantage over the other. This was a military judge trying to exert ordinary efforts at courtroom administration.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about a different aspect. So with regard to how the judge reacted to alleged infringement of his MRA 412 ruling. So during the opening statement, that became an issue, I believe, which led to sort of an extended hearing and discussion where the judge seemed to initially assume or believe that the defense had infringed that ruling. But at a later point during, I believe, a redirect of one of the witnesses, the defense argued that the government had infringed the ruling by implying that that witness, eliciting a statement from that witness that she had not made other allegations against the accused. Where there were other specifications or potential charges that had been raised but were not pursued at the court-martial. So if you could talk a little bit about the differences between how the judge dealt with those two situations, specifically with the latter one, it seems that the military judge he didn't sort of sanction or reprimand the government beyond saying that they should be more careful, And where it seems like the government arguably opened the door by bolstering the witness's credibility by an arguably misleading statement that she hadn't made other allegations that the members wouldn't have known about, and then didn't let the defense pursue that, and sort of interjected his view that it was better if he didn't, for the accused, if he didn't let the defense pursue that, as opposed to letting the defense make that assessment.
Yes, Your Honor. And so at some level of abstraction, there is the military judge discussing with the defense during their opening things that were potentially brushing up against the court's previous MRE 412 ruling, and then the circuit trial counsel's redirect examination of KMT during the trial. But once we get past that first level of abstraction, the differences matter, the context matters. And so the military judge heard the question from circuit trial counsel, which, as you noted, indicated on redirect was to ask her, have you made any additional allegations? Now, based upon the facts of this case, it may have been inartfully worded, but the military judge was not unreasonable or showing some sort of bias or favoritism by viewing it as not being as problematic as the defense suggested. The victim, ENS in this case, had made allegations that were not charged for various reasons, to include some pre-service conduct. And circuit trial counsel represented to the military judge, and there's some support in the record for circuit trial counsel's representation, that the question was geared towards that initial allegation. The initial allegation where there were multiple different offenses alleged, and some did not make it on the charge sheet, not because they were false or did not have enough evidentiary support, but because there were concerns, legal concerns, such as pre-service conduct. And the military judge, in light of those equities and in light of the specific nature of the question, determined that it did not open the door. However, cautioned circuit trial counsel to not open the door, to be very careful in their questioning so as not to open the door moving forward. Now, the second part of your question, Your Honor, was essentially whether it was improper for the military judge to not permit the defense to run through that line of questioning and cross-examine the named victim, ENS, about a line of certain allegations that were not charged, because the military judge thought that it would be fundamentally unfair or prejudicial to the accused, but his ruling was actually to keep it out under MRE 403. And I think this actually gets back to what the military judge's duties in this case, when he's presiding in an impartial manner, is to avoid the unnecessary waste of time, to avoid confusing the members, and in so doing, promote the ascertainment of truth. And that was ultimately what grounded the military judge's decision, was a concern under MRE 403, and the record supports that conclusion.
All right. Thank you. I know time is passing, and we do want to get to the KT testimony and production issue.
Thank you, Your Honor. So pivoting to the witness production issues, ordinary efforts at courtroom administration also involve the military judge applying the law as he understands it to the facts presented. At trial, appellant asked the military judge to compel KMT to appear at motions and testify as to the materiality of her mom's the materiality of statements made or a conversation between her and her mother shortly after the offense. Appellant had the burden to persuade the military judge that this relief was appropriate. On the law, the CDC relied upon Article 46 and RCM 703 and 701 as legal authority. On the facts, the CDC proffered an impeachment theory for KMT that this single conversation with her mother, not knowing specifically what it is, guessing what it was, but that this single conversation with the mother created a motive to fabricate the allegation out of whole cloth. The CDC called no witnesses in support of the motion, though he did provide a proffer from KMT's father, AT, that he had received a text message from KMT's mother saying that a brief text message saying that something's happened, you need to contact your daughter.
I'm sorry, did you say he called no witnesses?
He called no witnesses in support of the motion. I think I understand Your Honor's point. He did request to produce KMT, but he did not call any additional witnesses.
And what happened to his request to call KMT?
It was denied, Your Honor.
Can you explain why it was denied?
Yes, Your Honor. So the defense had the burden to demonstrate the relevance and necessity for both KMT's mother and KMT And those determinations were inextricably intertwined. And the standard for production is under RCM 703, but before I get to the specific rule-based standard, I want to explore some of the things that are discussed in appellant's brief and here at oral argument to put the government's perspective out there. So first, there was no discovery violation in this case. This allegation is captured as a willful and blatant discovery violation on the part of the government. But the problem with that line of thinking is we have definitions for what a party is under military practice. RCM 703 expressly defines what a party is. It is the appellant and his counsel and the United States and their counsel. Our Superior Court in LRE v. Kastenberg, looking at that same definition in RCM 103, expressly stated that a victim and her counsel are not a party. So we're operating in, as a court of criminal appeals, we're operating in that realm where, as a matter of law, the victim, KMT, and her counsel are not parties. Appellant asks that this court find her to be a quasi-party, even though that term is not found in Article 46, RCM 701 or 703, or indeed anywhere else in the code. It doesn't point to any legal authority to justify that particular term. And that matters when we talk about discovery violations, because RCM 701 just says that no party may impede access, not no quasi-party, not a witness, or any of the like. The record is clear that the government did nothing to impede the defense's access to KMT. In fact, they attempted to facilitate that. Circuit Defense Counsel, on the record, applauded the government's effort to respond to a late discovery request after the defense witness lists were due, after there any motions to compel witnesses were due. The defense submitted a request in discovery for KMT's contact information and name, and it's clear from the record that the contact information was provided, at least as best as the government could, and presumably names were attached to that, though her name is nowhere in the record, which gets back to relevance and necessity. But there's nothing more to indicate that the government had some discovery obligation in this case. Counsel talks about a Brady and Stiletto violation. Brady talks about exculpatory information known to the government. There's no indication that the government was aware of exculpatory information involving KMT or KMT's mother that wasn't already provided to the defense. They speculate that KMT's mother could have provided additional statements, and that's the impeachment theory that I referenced earlier, but there's no evidence of that. That's a guess. And similarly, in Stiletto, they indicate the government had some obligation to correct KMT's refusal to participate in a pretrial interview. Well, as the military judge noted several times on the record and pointed to United States v. Morris, the CM case from 1987, the military judge can't order a party to participate in a pretrial interview. These were not fully cooperating witnesses during the pretrial investigation. That they were unwilling to, that this third party, this being KMT, and to her father, were unwilling to provide this information to the father does not mean that the government has committed a discovery violation. Similarly, as there was no discovery violation under the RCM and Article 46, there was no constitutional violation. In the government's supplemental statement of authorities, we pointed to United States v. Lucas, a CMA case from 1978. The court was clear the government had no obligation to create evidence, pointed to the fact there's no general right of discovery in criminal cases beyond what's required by Brady v. Maryland. So that's that very, very clear standard of if there's exculpatory information known to the government, it must be provided. But putting the burden squarely on the defense to demonstrate materiality. Now, certainly this case is a bit older, and so now we have relevance and necessity for production at trial. But materiality is close enough, similar enough, that this court can look to that by analogy. And it rejected arguments about due process or elementary fairness related to production of witnesses if the defense can't meet their burden of production, and those standards matter. In Hennis, another case that we cited, a CAF case from 2020, the court was clear, speculation's not enough. In that case, the appellant sought to compel the production of a witness who wasn't just a fact witness, that according to his proffer, committed the charged crime. But that proffer was inconsistent with some of the other evidence in this case, and so the court found that, quote, speculation is not enough, end quote.
So, counsel, let me move you off of discovery a little bit and bring you back to KT's testimony or lack thereof. So why, in your view, did the judge not allow her to testify for the motion?
Your Honor, because the defense had not met their burden of production. They have an obligation under RCM 703 to demonstrate the relevance and necessity for producing KMT, and that is tied to showing that KMT's mother His testimony is both relevant and necessary because KMT, her testimony about her mother matters not if KMT's mother isn't relevant and necessary for the defense at this court-martial.
So what did the military judge find with regard to the mother's relevance and necessity, and how did he arrive at that determination?
Your Honor, he looked at the information that was presented to him, which I've already discussed, the proffer about what she could testify to, and found that that speculative offer was not enough. And that even, because it was raised in the context of an abatement motion, that even if this was, even if she was unavailable for trial, she was not so essential to a fair trial as to justify the remedy of abatement. And that's...
So to paraphrase, so she wasn't necessary and she also wasn't essential. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you keep citing relevant and necessary as the correct standard, and I would agree that was the correct standard. That's not the one the judge used, though. The judge used the unavailable standard. Right? In his ruling, he repeatedly refers to whether or not mother's testimony be of such central importance to an issue essential for a fair trial, which requires the prerequisite determination of unavailability, which that was never shown. So did the judge even use the correct standard in his ruling?
Your Honor, I think the record's clear that the judge did analyze this first under relevance and necessity before getting to the standard for unavailable witness in the context of a motion for abatement, because that would be a relevant analysis in an abatement motion. But he did initially have a colloquy with the with counsel about relevance and necessity. Circuit trial counsel had conceded that appellant met his burden as to relevance, but then contested whether appellant had met his burden based on speculation for necessity. The military judge, during a colloquy that followed, disagreed with circuit trial counsel, or at least expressed some equivocation about whether the defense had met their burden for relevance, but then found that the witness was not necessary, excuse me, under the standard. And so when the military judge pivots from after analyzing relevance and necessity to analyzing whether the witness was unavailable and essential to a fair trial, that particular part of the ruling is not dispositive to whether he abuses discretion up front on the relevance and necessity standard. It does, however, highlight the lack of materiality that even the defense's best case proffer about what KMT's mother would say in relation to the case more broadly. Because if we look back, KMT's mother was offered for an impeachment theory, that she had a conversation with her daughter that caused her daughter to view her interactions with appellant more differently, and then lodge a complaint that it was a criminal sexual assault. What was also in the record, and this actually gets back to United States v. Hennis, where the court looked at contradictory information in the record that contradicted the speculation that defense counsel was offering, but contradictory to the proffer regarding KMT's mother is these text messages from the accused, where he makes several statements that are indicative of consciousness of guilt. And that dramatically undercuts any allegation that she was material to the trial. I mean, in particular, he says that he has too much to drink, that he disrespected KMT. This is the biggest mistake I've ever made. I disrespected you. It'll take time to heal. Those are all unqualified apologies from the accused that were admitted in the government's possession, admitted as evidence, and before the court-martial. So
counsel,
the notion...
I'm sorry. You can finish your thought.
Yes, Your Honor. So the notion that... It undercuts any notion. The fact that appellant would apologize profusely and without qualification undercuts the notion that KMT fabricated this allegation from whole cloth after talking with her mother.
Okay. So, counsel, the record indicates that OSI didn't interview KT's mother. Is that correct?
Your Honor.
You don't believe that they interviewed her?
That's not my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay. But they did interview her father.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they did interview her roommate.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it appears the mother was one of the first people she talked to and described the events to. Is that fair from the record?
Based upon the proffer that was made and then the cross-examination of KMT mid-trial, yes, Your Honor, that becomes clear.
Wouldn't she have been a logical person for OSI to talk to as part of their investigation, and can you explain why they didn't talk to her?
Certainly, Your Honor. It's the timing that matters. So it became clear just prior to the court-martial, or at least it was becoming clear just prior to the court-martial, that KMT had talked with her mother. But then fast forward to KMT's cross-examination. That's the first time the military judge actually hears evidence, certainly, that KMT talked with her mother shortly after the offense. So at the time of the court-martial, that's not OSI's investigation. That is long since passed. So what was what was important or logical for OSI to pursue at the time exists in a realm where they don't necessarily know that KMT's mother is not a prior witness. That fact that she had talked with her mother was buried in reams of text messages and not necessarily apparent to everyone, much less the defense, until the week before trial.
Well, they interviewed KT, right? Wouldn't they have known from her who she talked to? Wouldn't that be a relevant question to ask?
Your Honor, I believe that they, and I might get the specifics of the question that was asked, but certainly during KMT's cross-examination, she was cross-examined on that on the topic of did she provide names to other witnesses, of people that she talked to following the offense, and she did not provide the name of the mother up front. The defense actually was able to cross-examine her on that in front of the members. And, Your Honor, I see I'm expiring in time. May I briefly conclude?
You may.
The record shows a military judge who strived to perform his duties impartially while exercising ordinary control over the courtroom. Appellant failed to carry his burden to demonstrate that relief was warranted after lobbying allegations of judicial bias with minimal support. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in rejecting those allegations. Furthermore, appellant should not be prevented to insert facts for the first time on appeal to bolster his recusal and mistrial motions when they were given every opportunity to voir dire the military judge on these matters. Appellant also failed to carry his burden to demonstrate that either KMT or KMT's mother were relevant and necessary to the defense. The military judge did not abuse his discretion by holding that the defense of their burden of showing how a witness would benefit the defense case. And for those reasons, we ask you to affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you may proceed.
Your Honor, just quickly addressing some of the comments made regarding recusal. The first one is with regards to the full disclosure. As we've mentioned several times throughout the questions with you, Your Honor, and with both myself and my other counsel, specifically, there was not a full disclosure, because when we were asked about the relationship they had, the relationship, in fact, is somewhat portrayed on the record. There is no specific time frame for when the mentoring happened. So we don't know. This is a colonel and a major. We don't know, did they potentially have an assignment together years ago where he acted as a mentor? So again, that is not really dispositive. And again, whether or not this issue, this very specific, again, reprimand on the record as well as censored on the record, happened before or after the mentoring. And again, it's not any and all interactions. This is a very specific interaction that is unlikely that this military judge had with any other counsel. It is unlikely that he would have censored and verbally reprimanded and even threatened with contempt another counsel. So that interaction should have come out in a full disclosure on the record when he accused the senior defense counsel of having made an accusation to his superior. Now, looking at with regards to how the military judge inserted himself throughout the trial, there were a couple of questions where Your Honors asked that question. And specifically with regards to being able to put information in the opening slides, as well as with being able to look at the ENS's testimony. And the judge determined what, in fact, the appellant's counsel should be able to do. He made decisions for them by claiming that he was protecting the appellant, even though the senior defense counsel had indicated, Your Honor, this question has come out. It has made it seem, it's bolstered her, and we know she made other accusations, and we want to be able to bring that out, and we've discussed it with our client, and this is something he is okay with and he would like to do. And the judge said, no, I'm protecting the appellant. I'm not going to let you do that. And he also did not infer that the senior trial counsel had done anything wrong. And he's like, I didn't read it that way. It seems to be, it was more of a mistake. Again, contrasted with how he treated defense with the previous military rule of evidence, KMT issue, where he allowed the senior trial counsel to attack them by saying they were bad faith, bad lawyering, disingenuous, flaunting his ruling, never even addressed that, and yet went after defense and said, why aren't you following my rulings? So again, there is malintent that he infers, there is different treatment of them, and those things really play out throughout this entire trial. And Your Honor, you did ask before about prejudice, and really to quickly bring back why there is prejudice under the Liljeburg factors, if in fact we are looking at an appearance of bias, again, looking at the motions that he ruled against them, majority of them, looking at the witness production that we just spent several minutes talking about with KMT, her mother, as well as Jacob, who were never provided, looking at this opening statement that was changed when the military judge reconsidered his ruling, missed in the midst of the opening statement, and so they had to, on the fly, adjust their strategy. Finally, with regards to not being able to ask ENS about those previous accusations, and finally, with the instructions that the defense had asked the judge to give about the overt acts related to the attempted sexual assault that the military judge refused to give, and then appellant was convicted of attempted sexual assault, but he was acquitted of abusive sexual contact, again, when this was happening in the middle of the attempted sexual assault. So there was injustice that happened. Now, looking at KMT, with regards to the discovery violation, the trial counsel was aware of a lot more because they had interviewed KMT, they had a pretrial interview, understanding that KMT did not have to do that with defense. They were aware that she spoke to her mother on the way home. This is not something that the defense was aware of. And even during the argument the defense made about meeting her and why she was so relevant, they didn't correct the record. They didn't indicate, Your Honor, we actually know that that's incorrect. She spoke to the mother on the way home. They were also aware that she spoke to a friend. And, Your Honor, Chief Judge Johnson, you asked about this and said, well, why did OSI not do anything? OSI didn't do anything because OSI was precluded from even being aware that the mother was contacted because KMT did not tell them. She specifically, the first person, we know this from her testimony, that she spoke to, she did not tell them that she spoke to them. And then yet she did indicate that she'd spoken to her father and her roommate, and that's why OSI interviewed them. Trial counsel never attempted to interview the mother, even though they had a pretrial interview with her, and now know she's the first outcry witness. Again, they never correct that on the record. They never provide any statements to defense about the inconsistent statements, about the fact that she spoke to the mother on the way home, the fact that she spoke to a friend later. None of this information was presented to defense, and defense went in and was pretty much ambushed when they heard these questions on cross-examination during direct examination. And, Your Honor, I see I'm running out of time, so pending further questions, I will conclude. So the military judge, he abused his discretion by failing to recuse himself due to the appearance of bias under RCM 902A, as well as due to the actual personal bias that he had toward the senior defense counsel under RCM 902B1. And finally, the lack of producing KMT and the fact that the government was actually aware that she was important, that they failed to actually do anything to discover her or produce any more information for defense, that was an abuse of the discretion on the military judge for, again, failing to compel her or to require an abatement.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, we thank you for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All right.